Hello, everybody. My name is Dustin Pischel, and today's guest is Brian Husky. Brian is an actor, comedian, and writer. Brian is the co-creator and star of the hit TV specials Mr. Neighbor's House 1 and 2. Brian is also the co-star of the TV shows Damage Control. Brian has also appeared on hit TV shows such as New Girl, House, Community, Bob's Burgers, NCIS, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, How I Met Your Mother, American Dad, The Mindy Project, The Goldbergs, Parks and Recreation, among many other hit TV shows. Brian has also appeared in well over 30 movies such as The Bourne Identity, Superbad, This Is the End, Step Brothers, Tarzan, Neighbors, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Ant-Man, among many other hit movies. Brian has also appeared as a guest on TV shows such as The Daily Show, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, Conan, among many other hit TV shows. Please welcome the amazing Brian Husky.
Dustin, thank you for that amazing intro. And I have to set the record straight. I don't know why. I was not in Bourne Identity, but it keeps showing up on my IMDb. I keep taking it off, and I don't know if some algorithm thinks I was in that movie.
Yeah.
So I'll take the credit, you know. Yeah. It makes me seem cooler.
Every now and then, like, something like that happens. Like, I go on Google, and it says they were in something, but apparently they weren't in that. It's so odd.
Yeah, I think you can't really trust the internet all the time.
Yeah.
Definitely. There's another credit that's on there. It's like Southern Ghost Houses, and apparently they interviewed me because I'm an expert on Southern Ghosts. I'm not, and I was not interviewed on that.
Yeah.
So there's some Professor Brian Husky who probably, like, teaches at Savannah College or something.
Yeah.
You got on there.
Like,
so I was saying, okay, before we start, I was saying I'm very impressed by you.
Thank you.
I was like, so who is this kid who's, like, reaching out on Instagram, and you're so organized and you're so focused and professional. So if you are interested in going in the comedy, which I will interview you about, you're off to a great start, because you're really your drive and focus is really
Thank
great.
Thank you. I want to, like, do a lot of you do a lot of, like, comedic character acting. I never watched the Mr. Neighbor's House, but I heard a lot about it. Like, that series, like it was very popular, I hear, and stuff like that.
Oh, was it? That's good to hear.
Well, like, I saw it, like, 3 times, like, stuff where, and usually you don't see that, like, for the longest time, I didn't know about this show. It was, like, a 7-season hit TV show. It was, like, really famous, like, Modern Family famous, and a guy on my podcast appeared on it. Well, we had to change the date, so we never got on, but I was like, what is the show? I thought it was, like, one of those, and it turned out to be this hit, so, yeah, it's really cool.
Well, there's so many channels now. It's really crazy, you know? Yeah. I had a friend who was on a show on CBS All Access, and it ran for, like, 5 seasons, and his first response was probably about what you were about to say. Is like, what's that? How do I get that? Like, where is that thing? And so there's all these, like, now there's just, like, channels within channels within channels.
Yeah.
So, which is good, because there's more opportunity to make stuff, but it also, you have to be kind of realistic. A lot of times you'll make stuff and you'll have a much smaller slice of the pie.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
Did you do a lot of Second City or UCB stuff?
I'm Upright Citizens Brigade Theater. Yeah, that's where I started. I started kind of late. I was a photographer before I became, and I played in a band before started doing comedy. So I had always wanted to do it, and I was roommates with an actor by the name of Rob Corddry, who was on The Daily Show, and he's been on a number of other things. And he just kind of encouraged me to do it. Like, I just needed somebody to say, like, hey, you're funny, you should do this. So I didn't start in earnest. I didn't start taking, like, improv classes and stuff till I was, like, 28.
Yeah.
So you've got 15 years on when I started.
Well, I actually started about 14 months ago. And what I want to do is I want to get into the I want to get into Second City and UCB, and then when I turn 18, I want to go into writing for television. I know the Harvard Lampoon has some stuff, and I'm pretty sure there's this other Emerson College, but I want to get into writing for television and do a lot of sort of sketch comedy in my early 20s and work my way up so I can be a full-time stand-up comedian and do some producing and acting on the side.
Cool. Do you feel more comfortable, like, is writing sort of your, where, how your brain works? Because a lot of times people start, I started off thinking that I wanted to do writing, like, when I was in high school. And I similarly wanted to go to Emerson College. I got in, but my parents were like, oh, all these places you got into, we can't afford, so you're going up the road here.
Well, I love writing and performing, so, like, I know some comedians, which I find unbelievable, they hate writing. Like, if you all have a career in comedy, you should enjoy writing comedy. Because, like, if you want to be successful, you're going to have to write a lot. So, yeah, I love both things.
Yeah. I think there's two different versions of writing in comedy. There's sort of, like, sitting down, having to write a script comedy. And then there's just generating material, which a lot of stand-ups do. They'll just, like, write down bits, you know.
Yeah.
But I think the first one can be a little labor-intensive, because it you sort of end up sitting by yourself. Like, I've written a few movies, and I was like, wow, my butt is numb. I've been sitting in this chair for so long.
Yeah. So you were, I usually start off, well, you do a lot of, you are a comedian, but not a stand-up comedian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, I came out of improv.
Yeah.
Like I said, the Upright Citizens Brigade. So that was sort of where I learned, I guess that is where I learned my acting chops as well.
Yeah, so, like, when you ever, like, interviewed on, like, a guest of, like, a TV show or anything, like, or as when you were a guitarist in the, when you played guests, bass guitar in the band Bicycle Face. So either one of those, what's the worst heckler you have ever had?
Oh, wow. Well, it would probably be back when I was playing in a band. More often than not, like, the guitarist for the band I was with, we both spent probably half the time doing bits on stage. Like, we were unintentionally funny band. And so more often than not, we would have somebody from the audience yell, like, shut the F up, scream at us. But there was one time, he wasn't a heckler, but he was a guy who was, after the show, he watched our whole show, and then he came up, and he was, like, drunk, and he was like, give me my money, man, come on. I was like, oh, I'm sorry, I think you think I'm somebody else. He's like, come on, Keith, give me my money, man. Don't mess around with me, Keith. Yeah. He started to grab me. I was like, I'm not Keith, and I pulled out my driver's license, I showed it to him, and he was like, anybody can get that made anywhere, Keith, give me my $20, man.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the bar owner, like, came out and pulled him off of me and said, like, this is not Keith, man. He's like, oh, you're right, Keith is bald.
Yeah. Yeah, there are, like, where were you playing? Was it more of, like, a redneck area or something?
I grew up in North Carolina, so it was, there was not where I grew up and where I performed, it wasn't so much redneck, but it was, there was a strong southern bent to a lot of the people. But when, that was in Virginia, and that was at Virginia Beach.
Yeah.
So that was, those beach communities, they get rough. You gotta be careful.
Yeah, like, it's sort of weird how, what was I gonna say? But, like, a lot of times, like, you can, like, I could imagine exactly what that person would look like, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. So,
apparently he really needed that $20, it meant a lot to him, so.
Yeah. Imagine half of his teeth is missing from that meth that he was supposed to buy. So, what are your craziest on-set stories?
One of... it wasn't necessarily on set, but one of the craziest things that happened to me that I was like, oh, I'm glad this didn't go badly. Two things. I'll tell you two things. Yeah. So the first one was I was used to do when I was in New York. I lived there for 10 years, and that's when I was doing started doing improv. One of the things that you could do if you were sort of like moving up the ranks in our theater is Conan O'Brien used to have his late night show in New York, and they used to do like really insane, really funny sketches and just like weird character pieces. So you would get a random call like, hey, can you be here this afternoon? We need you to dress up like a lobster and type a letter, you know, something insane. So my bit was, have you ever heard of this Triumph the Insult Comic Dog?
Yeah, I've heard about them.
Yeah, so it's this totally dumb bit that this writer named Robert Smigel, he used to be a Saturday Night Live writer. He would come on and he had this like hand puppet. This is this little like a dog with a bow tie, and he's holding a microphone. And the dog is an insult comic.
Yeah.
So he would just like get in people's face. He holds the puppet up and be like, well, what are you? You are so stupid I should poop on you. And so they were doing a thing where they were opening. They were doing the big opening for the revamp of the Star Wars. You know, franchise.
Yeah.
So they had all these Star Wars fans outside lining up for the movie, and they would go through and mess with all the guys in the audience or waiting in line. So I dressed up like Spock. They dressed me up like Spock, and I just walked down the line and flipped them all off. But so they put Spock ears on me. We shot for a couple hours, and then they're like, okay, let's go back to the studio. By the time we got to the studio, it was like 8 p.m., and all of their crew had left, including the makeup people. So I was stuck with Spock ears on my ears. And they're like, oh, I guess you'll just have to wear them home and come back tomorrow. I'm like, I'm not going to wear Spock ears on the train in New York by myself, like, and until tomorrow. And if I look back on it, like, that's the most normal place on Earth to wear Spock ears and ride the train.
Yeah.
But luckily, there's somebody else up at Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
So we went up there, and their makeup person, they took it off. But they were just like, yeah, don't worry about it. You can sleep in it and stuff. It's like, no, it's silicone. I don't want to have these fake ears.
Yeah.
And then the other crazy thing that happened was there's a show that is available now on Netflix that used to be on Adult Swim called Children's Hospital, which I encourage you to watch because it's a very funny – it's like it's a parody of sort of like – hospital dramas, but it's so crazy. Like, it gets so crazy. So I have this character named Chet, who's an ambulance driver who may or may not be a serial killer. but I had to do, for whatever reason, I had to wrestle a sumo wrestler. Like, and so they had a real sumo wrestler. And I told him, I was like, okay, I'm nervous because I hurt my back recently, so I need you to be careful. And he's like, okay. He sort of understood English. It wasn't his first language, but he, in the first take, he picked me up and body slammed me onto my back.
Oh, my God.
Because I weigh, you know, like 140 pounds, and he weighs 440 pounds.
Yeah.
So I think it's just like, it's basically him picking up a broom or something. And I thought I was paralyzed for a second. Like, I did. I lay there, and I was like, I don't know if I should move. If I scratch my nose, if I'm going to be paralyzed or not, but it wasn't. And the good thing is they got some great footage out of it, and the editor did my head bouncing on the on the mat on a loop, so it looked like my head was just like bobbing up and down. And that was very funny. But I sacrificed myself.
I remember once I had Brian Scolaro on my podcast. And he was doing Girl Meets World. And Girl Meets World is one of those, like, Disney teen things, but only, like, 9-year-olds watch it. And apparently one of the main characters, like, there was this man that attacked him because Brian was getting all of the laughs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I've encountered, maybe during your, by the time you get into comedy, people will be a little more, I don't know.
Sane?
Egos won't be such a big thing, but I worked with one time with an actor where he's doing the scene, he was the main dude. I improvised something at the end of the line, and I got a big laugh, and he playfully hit me with his script, saying, like, hey, you, don't be so funny, but he hit me really hard.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, man, don't hit me with your script.
Yeah.
And the audience, and then like people laughed at that, and he didn't like that either. Yeah. So he playfully did it again, and I was like, okay, I'm just going to walk away.
Yeah.
I felt like I was about to get in a fight.
Yeah, I heard those like Saturday Night Live, those old days, people were like snorting cocaine, they were doing everything, and that just makes me think, like, how did they even get away with all of that? Like, yeah, they've been doing it for like 20, well, they don't do it as much anymore, but they were probably doing it from 1976 was when it started.
Mm-hmm, I think so, something around there.
To like probably
there used to be a whole thing, I think, in entertainment where it was just like, they're like, well, I mean, that's just how performers and artists are. They're you know, out of control, and if we try to control them, they won't be as funny. But I think that's just, I think now that people's tolerance for that kind of behavior is zero. There's like, no, come on. If you can't do it, then get all set. I think the only person that can get away with it is Seth Rogen, but he smokes pot for like medicinal reasons.
Yeah, well, like, Tommy Chong also gets away with it. Sam Kennison. Well, do you think like Sam Kennison started? Like, yeah, Sam Kennison might have started the whole thing with a more outrageous comedy.
Well, I think he was. I don't know if he started it. If I kind of feel like in stand up, just in comedy, if someone is sort of like busting out as some like, oh, this has never been done, everybody borrows from everybody, you know. So I'm sure that he's probably, because he used to be a pastor, actually. He used to be a preacher. So I think the interviews I'd heard with him is that part of it was he was just used to that fire and brimstone delivery, you know, that kind of evangelical, like, I'm going to save your soul. But he just turned it into his own frustration. So it was just a voice for his own frustrations that he was feeling. But that whole period of comedy, do you know this comedian Bobcat Goldthwait?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, and he had that weird voice and stuff. That period of comedy, there were a lot of comedians who had these like caricatures. You know, they weren't necessarily themselves. They were like these huge inflated versions of themselves.
Yeah, like Gilbert Gottfried, Sam Kennison,
Judy Tenuta. Yeah.
Would you say I had Lavelle Crawford on my podcast recently. I think he's a caricature comic because he does a fake voice.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's kind of a trope of just like old vaudeville days. You know, you just come out and you're wearing your little costume and you do your bit and stuff. Mm-hmm. But at some point in comedy, people were like, he'll come back later. But in the 50s, there's a start of sort of being more self-reflective, being sort of a little more personal about yourself and kind of autobiographical. So,
I think a lot of, it really changed a lot of it. Like, I remember I'm reading the comedians. I'm not reading it that much for school because we have to read like 20 pages for school a day on a personal book. And these pages are just like giant. So I just read like Boy and Standing Up and stuff with small pages. So it talks a lot about like how people like Lenny Bruce were the ones that really
exactly who I was trying to think of. Yeah. I kept thinking, I was like, Bruce McGill? No, Lenny Bruce. That's who I was like.
Yeah, they were the ones that started to, my dog's barking. But they were really the ones that started to be more personal and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which a lot of the audience reacted badly to. Like, I don't want to hear about you. Tell me how funny footwear is. What's going on? You know?
Yeah, I really liked that moment in comedy. Like, just sort of what sparked, like, it's sort of the whole atmosphere. It was just so, like, everything was just so, like, chaotic with the Comedy Store strike and everything going on. It was, like, a lot of comedy, like, George Carlin's people were getting angry at and stuff like that.
Yeah. It's interesting. There's a lot, 'cause I used to play in a band, and it's interesting how similar just, I mean, the job of being in entertainment is very similar in whatever venue you kind of go into, but it also attracts all sorts of, like, weirdo people from the outside, you know? Yeah. So it's like, if you want to be the sort of creative force, you're going to either have to work with people who want to sort of, like, sell you,
yeah,
or, you know, have a part of you, or just be part of a community. Like, that's the other thing, is like, you sort of, which is good and bad. Like, a lot of times it's like, oh, you'll meet really wonderful people, and then sometimes you're like, oh, these people don't have anybody else, so yeah, they're coming here.
So what's so can you tell us about your podcast with Charlie Sanders, Bald Talk?
Sure, I'll promote my own podcast on your podcast. Bald Talk is a podcast where two bald comedians talk to bald actors, directors, wig makers, bass guitarists, musicians, really anyone who is bald, about the experience of being bald.
Yeah.
That's the starting point. And really, as we've done it, we've sort of found it's more about, like, people talking about their own sort of physical insecurities, yeah, or, you know, the things that sort of, like, they're a little, like, they feel a little icky about themselves.
Yeah.
And then we just interview people as well. So it's it started off as just like, well, here's a dumb idea, let's see if this works. And then it's kind of like just kept going. And it was a great thing to do during the pandemic, because it just kept us sane.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You recently had Fred Melamed on your podcast.
Yeah, he's a great dude. I loved him. I was such a fan. He had been on Children's Hospital, and I sort of nerded out on him because I saw him in A Serious Man, this Coen Brothers film, and he blew my mind. I just thought he was so good. But yeah, he's bald, and he's great. So yeah, that's all you need.
So So 7 years ago, you went viral for playing Google for If Google Was a Guy on College Humor, and the series received well over 150 million views.
Seriously?
So, yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. I did not know that.
And that's like, it was in between the span of, I think, 6 or 7 episodes.
Yeah,
wow. So that's crazy.
I knew it got a lot, but I had no idea it was like a small country's worth.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
Well, no, that's not a small country, like, considering, like, all the countries. Well, a lot of the countries, like, there's 300 countries, and not a lot of them have 100 million people. I mean, some of them do. There would be 30 billion people in the world for a split. Why am I even talking about that?
This is so important. Yeah. Well, we'll just say it's as much as 2 small countries. How about that? That sounds even more impressive.
So what was that like? So what was that experience like for you?
It was super fun. I was very grateful that somebody came up with, like, a kind of rock solid comedy framework to work with them, because I was like, oh my God, that's so easy. Like, I just react to the insane things that people type on Google. So and I've done stuff with College Humor before. I used to do a lot of stuff for Funny or Die, and there was, you know, there's this kind of, like, empire battle between the two of them. I sort of had waited to do some stuff for College Humor when Funny or Die sort of, like, was switching out. But yeah, it was really cool. The way they would shoot it at first, it was, they would shoot, they'd have someone on the other, like, sitting across some desk for me, and they would shoot my side and then their side. They'd shoot all my side, and then in the afternoon, they shoot everybody else's side. And then the next round we did, they couldn't schedule it that way, so they just, it was just a day of me shooting my reactions to people who weren't there all day long, and then they just stuck them together. And then during pandemic, we were getting ready to do a whole new series of them just before, and pandemic happened, so we ended up doing 2 animated versions of it. which are online right now.
Yeah.
And not, I think that viral moment might have passed because they were not getting 150 million. They were getting less. But I think everyone was doom scrolling, so maybe that was the problem.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like, a lot of times, like, everything on the internet, like, well, more like, everything, like, goes by so fast, like, things that are viral, they quickly become so awesome, they, like, it's like, oh my god, it's so cool, to then,
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I would say for your generation, I'm very curious what entertainment will be, and what the, I don't know, what the either attention span for something that is, like, quote, a hit, or, like I was saying, that how much things are going to be kind of broken up into all these little platforms and networks and, you know, and your TikToks and all your, you know, your uploads and your LinkedIns.
Yeah. So, well, I think it's going to be divided into, like, social media entertainment, and then you have your Netflix, you have your Hulu, because those have always been, like, separated, because sometimes, like, you just want to explore through TikTok or Instagram, you just want to scroll down, but, like, once you're in the mood for sort of, like, something that's actually, like, good, it's not just, like, made up in a quick 15 minutes or whatever.
Right.
You want to watch.
What's your opinion on people who cross over, you know? Because I do think there are people who will do, who was that? Sarah Cooper started off online. She was doing these really funny impersonations of Donald Trump, where she would just kind of, like, basically lip sync to his audio. And she's, like, a young African-American performer, so, and female too, you know, so it's like there's nothing Donald Trump about her, but somehow, like, the way she was doing the videos was just really funny and really spot on. But she ended up getting, like, doing a special out of it. But I know some other performers who sort of started on YouTube or TikTok, once they get that shot, they don't really have the skill set.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on that?
I think a lot of them don't have the skill set. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are some that do have the skill set, but a lot of times it's just like, oh, you made one good joke, and then, like, you made one good thing, and then you, like, you try to milk it out as much as you could. You made other things about that. You did one video, then you made another video about that. You try to branch it out, but then you only, like, could do one. A lot of times they only have one talent, or it's just like, not really luck, but they came up with a good joke idea, but that isn't regular basis. They don't actually know how to write a skit. They don't know how to do stuff like that. They were a lot of times just lucky enough to have something that's funny. And a lot of times I feel like it's just the same old regurgitated I mean, not always, but there's one person who, like, creates it, and then a bunch of other people like do the same thing, and they lip sync it. Well, not lip sync it, because it's not a song. Like, if it's a skit, they lip sync it. Excuse me. But, like, a lot of it, they don't even come up with it. So I think a lot of it's just, like, it's regurgitated stuff. And unless they do know how to, like, act and stuff like that, unless they are actually good at it and they have talent and they've worked at it, I don't think it's meant for them.
I mean, I think one of the good things is that, like, you can, if you have a body of work, like, mm-hmm. if you were pointing out, if you're more than just, like, a one-joke wonder, you know, you can sort of, maybe you have your one that's, like, your big hit and stuff, but so if you keep posting stuff, you're like, oh, yeah, I can go back and see a full range of somebody's, like, comedic ideas and stuff, yeah. which is kind of amazing, you know, like, it definitely cuts through a lot of, steps that we had to do growing, you know. For me, it was just like, unless they came to see us perform, we were kind of out of luck, because it was before people were uploading anything, really.
Yeah,
this is back in the 1910s I'm talking about, way back.
I think a lot of the smaller platforms a lot of times are sort of underrated, because a lot of times the people that do it all, like, Well, don't get me wrong. A lot of times they just have skill sets at social media. They know how to, brand it, which is important. But like that, like they have, not that good. They are they're semi good at comedy. They're semi good at acting. They're semi good at putting stuff up on social media, making the hashtags or whatever for it. So a lot of times they are not the best at every category, which you can't really be unless you're doing it for a lifetime. You need to focus on maybe at most 3 categories.
Yeah. But it's interesting. I just one of the things that's been really interesting for me and a lot of my contemporaries, like at the Upright Citizens Brigade and stuff, is just the shift towards, and the very rightful shift towards, like, political awareness in what the kind of jokes you can make, who can make the jokes, who's speaking on behalf of who, or about someone. Because there, a lot of comedy used to be this kind of observation of, and, you know, if you did it from a personal place, it was an observation of your reaction to something. But a lot of it was commentary on others, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we're sort of at this point now where it's like, I did, especially as, like, a middle-aged white dude, it's like, I am in no position to sort of to do that. Yeah. But it's been an interesting thing in comedy, because a lot of comedy is about taking an uncomfortable subject matter and kind of looking at it from another angle. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you look at it from another angle, it calls up what's ugly or uncomfortable about it.
Yeah.
But that's to sort of make a point. You know, a lot of times that's the point of satire. You'll blow out something. You'll be sort of extreme with an idea. And people have a hair trigger reaction now where they will just react to what's being blown out, and they won't sort of wait for the point of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know if, like, is that, do you feel, have you started sort of, like, messing around with doing stand-up or writing material?
I've been writing and performing for about 14 months now, and, yeah, I've been doing that. I've been writing and performing frequently.
Yeah. Is there any stuff, have you had any stuff that people have said, like, oh, you can't say that, that made me uncomfortable, or there, you know, any of that kind of stuff? Because it's good to get the feedback, because a lot of times you don't, you forget how someone else might react to it.
Well, a lot of my comedy, I have autism, so I do a lot of jokes about autism, and sometimes people are like, they're offensive, but it's like, I have autism, I'm allowed to do these jokes, so I think for some people it's hard to realize that. But yeah, I like to do stuff like that, like absurd, because a lot of my comedy is absurd. It's not shock value, but I have absurdity in it, so I think a lot of, like, that's one of the elements of comedy, and I'm just not gonna get rid of it if it makes someone feel a little bit bad. Because say it's making 50 people entertained, but it makes one person low, it's making more people happy than it's making sad, so it may be like, oh, they're making them a little sad, but overall, it's a better thing because you're making everyone else happy.
Yeah, it's a tough, I mean, that's one of those things of, and I'm not necessarily sort of like talking about cancel culture or anything like that, but I think there's a, it's people sort of like, kind of like, I don't know, okay. At best, comedy is something that kind of, like, catches you off guard. Or if you go to see a comedy show, you're like, I know this guy's going to be funny. So you're kind of in the mindset for it to be funny. But some comedians, it is about provocation. It is about sort of, like, you know, it's like, if you look at all the tropes of, like, the language used, like, oh, I slayed, I killed, I owned that audience. It's a lot of, it can be kind of like, oh my God, is this like a murder scene or something?
Yeah.
But it is kind of like you want the audience to sort of be participating with you, but also kind of, you want to control their experience a little bit.
You want...
And I think more and more, it's like you said, like, there are going to be people in the audience who are not going to want to be controlled or react or have the patience to sort of see, like, what is this going to pay off? And that is still for them. But I think a lot of people are, I don't know if a lot of people, but I think a lot of the gatekeepers, which would be like networks or, you know, the people who put money behind it, they don't want to deal with the, they want to make sure that everybody is pleased, which is not always going to be the case.
Yeah, well, you can't try to please everyone. That's unrealistic. Like, I don't mean to bash, but a lot of these Tonight shows, they wear suits, they look very proper, they have some proper jokes in, for 70, like, people that are 40 to 70, and then they have these other jokes that are, like, meant for, like, people that are younger, 20s, 30s, teenagers. Yeah. It's like, choose your audience, choose your niche, you can't have it all. So that's what I think a lot of people need to realize.
Yeah. I used to be on a show called Beep, which was on HBO, and it was like a political satire show about the vice president, and just, you know, it was like a very funny version of like how bad politics are.
Yeah.
But in the last season, they had a joke that was about, it was centered around sort of like gun control, right? And they had this joke that was incredibly dark that involved like a school shooting. But at the same time, it was so dark and so truthful that they're like, ah, we gotta do it. Because they just have like really brutal jokes like that.
Yeah, well, if
and, it's... And, you know, people were like, people are gonna really like react to this. And and it's true. It got reaction of like, oh my god! It, you know, people would like flinch at it, and then other people would be like, they'd flinch, but they'd like laugh at like how painfully truthful it is.
Yeah,
I think that's one of the best versions.
That's a lot of times like what comedians do is they just we're supposed to like even if it sounds absurd, so offensive. If it's the truth, I feel like it's our duty to tell it because it's offensive. But at the end of the day, it's only 10 seconds that's going to last where you're offended versus it's going to change your entire look at something. So the risk is much greater than the benefit.
Exactly. That's a good point. I think going back to Sam Kinison, you know, if you look at his stuff now, he's pretty hateful towards women. And he was pretty hateful. Like, he expressed a lot of I guess he had unhappy relationships and stuff. And so that is sort of a use of your platform that is dangerous because I think there's a danger sometimes to be like, I'm just kidding. It doesn't matter. It doesn't mean anything. But if you're screaming things, you know, calling women like offensive names and saying that they would die, there are people who are recipients of that information who are like, who think that way anyway. So it's a lot like sort of like the platform that Trump ended up with. Like, he was giving a lot of permission to people who felt sort of like hidden away that they couldn't like be out and out racist or be misogynist or be anti-immigrant, you know? And then once somebody else is being loud and publicized and heard, that gives us other people permission. So that's definitely, you know, a thing where our awareness of like, it's a funny thing like it happens with our podcast. A lot of times we'll forget that we're doing a podcast and we'll forget the things we're talking about. We'll go out and sort of be amplified out to other people. Yeah. So sometimes we'll just like, oh, let's take that out because that could be taken out of context. And we didn't mean that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's just an interesting thing right now where I think comedians don't have the hall pass to be like, I'm a comedian, I can say whatever I want, you know, because there's more accountability. I guess that's it.
Well, what you have to realize is a lot of times comedians, like, will say absurd stuff like character comics. A lot of times their character is just an asshole. And a lot of times the reason that's so funny is it's bad if they actually think that way, but if it's, like, if they're just, like, being an asshole, but the thing is, like, they know they're being an asshole, and that's the reason it's so funny, because of the absurdity in it, that sort of, like, it sort of shines a light that so many people are laughing at it, that it's bad, but it's such a, like, touchy subject, like,
yeah,
you're being a character comic, but you don't want people to think that's actually how you think as opposed to, but it's such a touchy subject.
Yeah, yeah. So imagine if you were, like, Sam Kinison or any of these sort of, like, 80s stand-ups who are, like, you know, people who see them in real life are like, oh, my God, it's Weird Al Yankovic. He must be insane. And he's like, no, I'm just kind of a normal guy.
Yeah.
You know, people really believe, people believe what's on TV very, very readily.
Yeah. The thing about Sam Kinison is, like, I don't know if he was, like, always sexist. I know, like, when in the later, I don't know if he was always or not. But I know in his later years that he was, like, very angry. He was a very, like, mad. Because, like, he was a very, I think, it may have all started with, like, all of his drug addictions that might have had an effect on his brain. Like, some people, my brother knows this person, and their father got a seizure, and they used to be this nice guy, and now they're, like, angry, so he might have gone one of those, like...
Yeah, I think drug addiction a lot of times, drug addiction coupled with fame a lot of times, just it creates a very distorted sort of, like, worldview that's hard to get out of. And kind of, it's like what we were talking about earlier of, there's less tolerance now, I think, for bad behavior. But if your performer is sort of built on this, like, bad boy image of partying and being out there and insane, that's only going to get supported and kind of, like, stoked. So I'm sure at a certain point, he might have lost touch with Sam Kinison, the person he was, and the performer, you know.
Yeah.
But it's hard to know.
Yeah, they get blended together, they get mixed up, because, like, I don't think he was always, like, because I hear that, like, when he was really young, he got hit by a truck, and that, like, made him, like, and after that, he started acting out and stuff like that. He was 10 years old, so, yeah, he's been, like, he's come through a lot of injuries, I think.
Yeah. Well, that is one thing. I don't know if you've sort of, in your comedy, like, researching and stuff, but there's a lot of people go into comedy, or go into the arts, to deal with something very personal that maybe they weren't aware of, that they sort of suffered through, or that they were aware of, and they're trying to get away from, you know? Because I realized at a certain point that a lot of my early comedy was very, like, intentionally kind of, like, I love dark characters. I love, like, really sort of, like, tortured dark characters. Yeah. And so a lot of that came from relationship stuff with my with my dad, you know. It's like, I didn't realize that until for a long time. And then I started to notice my other friends who were basically playing their dads in scenes. And we're like, oh, we're just working out our stuff with our dad. Yeah. So.
I remember, there's a lot of crazy stuff. Like, a lot of people that get into, like, I do a lot of my jokes about, like, how I have autism and stuff like that, because it's sort of a way to make fun of it, like, and you're still escaping, like, all the stuff, like, I used to get bullied at school, like, they didn't know that I had autism, but they could sense that something was different about me. Like, a lot of times they feel like it's sort of an escape, and, like, it's sort of something where you can be vulnerable, and you can really talk about your emotions and still keep it funny. That's one of the reasons I loved it so much. I love it so much.
There's a lot of, not a lot, but there's a notable number of writers, and then performers who sort of lean more towards writing, who either were autistic or were sort of on the spectrum and didn't know it for a long time. But there's one writer who I knew from The Onion who found out later, was diagnosed late in his life, that he was autistic, and he was like, oh, yeah, that explains a lot of how he sort of approached the world and stuff. But I think he just early on went in the county out of curiosity, and he had the same thing. He's like, yeah, it just gave me I could make sense of the world through comedy.
Yeah.
So it was really helpful.
Something I've always been curious of, like, I don't know, I remember I was diagnosed with autism when I was 6, but I don't remember when I found out. I don't remember if my parents sat me down or whatever. But, like, I wonder if I always, like, if I knew what autism was before I knew that I had autism. Like,
right.
What my thoughts were on people with autism. And, like, and then how everything changed when I found out I was autistic.
I imagine it would be more helpful to know, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, just in terms of, because growing up, everyone feels, when you're sort of figuring yourself out, mm-hmm. everyone feels strange in relation mm-hmm. to one another. But I guess if you sort of have a thing like, oh, well, here's how I am, it allows you to sort of, like, adjust for it.
Yeah. I think it's helped me out, like, sort of, like, just knowing that I have it and, like, certain, like, struggles I have and why I'm this way, well, why I do certain things and stuff like that.
Do you mind if I ask, like, what are some of the things you struggle with about it?
Because
I know very little.
Yeah.
About that,
no problem. I struggle with a lot of times. It used to be more prominent in my life. I used to struggle with sort of, like, being in control of my emotions and stuff like that. Well, partially because I was more, when I was younger, I was really emotional and something else. I used to not have the best social skills, but over time through a bunch of groups and stuff, camps and everything, I've improved at my social skills, but.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, it's funny to hear that part because I feel like, oh, I'm still doing that. I still feel like an awkward 10-year-old sometimes,
yeah.
like at age 53. Like,
Yeah. So, thank you so very much for being a guest on my podcast. It was an honor.
Man, it was a thrill.
Yeah. It was an honor and delight having you on. And before we go, is there any social media or anything you would like to plug?
Yeah, let's see. What should we plug? You can follow me on Instagram or Twitter. I don't do much on Twitter. I think Twitter's scary. My handle is TheBrianHusky. Please listen to our podcast, Bald Talk, even if you are a fully haired young 13-year-old fan of this show. We get some good people in there, and we hopefully are funny.
Mm-hmm.
And what else? I don't know. Look for me on TV. I pop up as much as I can.
Yeah.
And do watch my comedy specials, Mr. Neighbor's House and Mr. Neighbor's House 2. I think they're available on YouTube, but they're also available on the Adult Swim website.
Okay.
And I will say this, it is a horror comedy. It is like if David Lynch made a kid's show. So it's really dark and really weird.
Yeah. So thank you so very much, and goodbye, and have an amazing day.
You too. Thanks, Dustin.